comforting the afflicted, afflicting the comfortable, bringing faith to the doubtful, doubt to the faithful, friend to the friendless, odor to the odorless, telling lame radio to rise and talk. This is Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett. And let me just give a quick shout out to everybody that was at the Edge Life Expo this evening and all the people we got to meet. Nice crowd. Thank you for the warm reception. Tell my daughter I'm okay. That's the title of Betty's case. In the book by Alan Bodkin, Dr. Alan Bodkin, it's about induced after-death communication, a new therapy for healing grief and trauma. And this is Betty's story. Betty had had a very close relationship with Hank, her father-in-law, before he died. She described him as a very gentle man with a heart of gold. After he retired, Hank would come daily to Betty's house to care for her two sons, his grandchildren, so that Betty and her husband could pursue their professional careers. When Hank suddenly died of a heart attack, Betty and her husband were just devastated. About 3 years later, Betty came to me, Dr. Alan Bodkin, for psychotherapy involving a problem not related to Hank. When the subject of her father-in-law's death came up during the course of therapy, it was clear that she had residual sadness. And that's when he explained to her induced after-death communication and asked her whether she would like to participate in a session to resolve her feelings about Hank's death. She laughed. She said, "It won't work with me. I'm much better with his death now. And besides, I don't believe in all that kind of stuff anyway." But she was willing to give it a try. Her sadness was not overwhelming, said Dr. Bodkin. But it did increase somewhat with a set of eye movements. More about that later. In any event, she went through it, the induced after-death communication, and said, "I can see him. It's Hank. He looks 20 years younger than when he died. He's thoroughly at peace and completely happy." She paused again for a few seconds and then opened her eyes. "He told me he is very proud of me and my husband, but you know something really interesting happened then. Hank's sister appeared. She died about 7 years before Hank, I think," she said, and said, "Tell my daughter I'm okay." Betty then told me, not only was she surprised at the communication with her father-in-law, but she was very confused by the fact that Hank's sister had appeared during her induced after-death communication. Betty explained to me that she had met Hank's sister on one occasion at a family reunion. She didn't even know her well and didn't know her daughter at all. But Betty was euphoric and kind of confused. She ended the session by saying, "I never would have believed it, but that was really Hank. I still don't know why his sister was there. I certainly didn't expect that. And how the hell am I going to tell her daughter that her mother's okay? She'll think I'm a total nutcase. But I didn't make this stuff up, doctor. It just happened." Betty's case is common among people who have experienced these induced after-death communications. Her experience was not at all consistent with her beliefs and expectations. She was not only very surprised that she had had one, but she was also startled by the appearance of Hank's sister, which she clearly believed was not of her making. It is not unusual for the patient to describe the deceased being with someone who is important to the deceased in life, but relatively unknown and unimportant to the patient. Well, that's just one of the doors into this very fascinating study. Work that Dr. Alan Bodkin should be very proud of, helping people get over grief and trauma through induced after-death communication. This is not hypnosis. This is not like anything else you very likely have ever heard before, except on Coast to Coast. And we'll get to that coming up next hour. News, email, and a fascinating first hour guest. He's a friend who had something very remarkable happen to him. Something you heard about in the news, but not everything about the story made the news. We'll let you know coming up this hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. A little crypto news and some email from last week's show coming up here on Coast to Coast. And also just, if I can, thank you everybody who emails in. We do the best we can when you write to respond to everybody. I can't always get everyone answered the way that you want, but you're always welcome to try at coasttocoastam.com. In the news, and this website, by the way, came from somebody who emailed in a couple of weeks ago, and it is a treasure trove of science stories, physorg.com, P-H-Y-S-O-R-G, physorg.com. And this fascinating story, you know, in the sci-fi movie The Matrix, a cable running from a computer into Neo's brain writes in visual perceptions. A Neo's brain can manipulate the computer-created world. In reality, scientists cannot interact directly with the brain because they do not understand enough about how it codes and decodes information. But, and in a story you can find there at physorg.com, neuroscientists in the McGovern Institute at MIT have been able to decipher a part of the code involved in recognizing visual objects. Now, practically speaking, computer algorithms used in artificial vision systems might benefit from mimicking these newly uncovered codes. The study appears in this week's issue of Science. We want to know how the brain works to create intelligence, said one of the researchers. Our ability to recognize objects in the visual world is among the most complex problems the brain must solve. Isn't that cool, though? I mean, how much longer before we can all dodge bullets from point-blank range like Neo? And maybe we could bring back Mouse. Poor Mouse. All right, so this one sent in by Dave. A pirate gang used rocket grenades and machine guns on a large cruise ship. The captain tried to run one down. This is just off the coast of Africa. But the passengers in the center of the floor of the ship then outran the attackers out to sea. It was on Global TV in Canada tonight, and it is on MSN News. And the story's all over, actually. It's part of a series of attacks by pirate ships on American and international cruise liners, where they're using fairly sophisticated weaponry to get the ships to surrender the booty, if you will. And I'll tell you this, I've never been on one of these cruise ships, but my wife has been on one, and she said, you know, after about 3 days into the cruise, they were dying for pirates. I mean, anything to happen. So, you know, maybe this is going to boost tourism after a while. This story comes from France. The setting fits the story. They say in the southern Alps of France, where the rising population of wolves has raised the ire of sheep owners. This rural area is where much of the country's wolf population resides. The animals, which reappeared in France only a few years ago, are stuck in the middle of a controversy similar to what we have here in this country on whether or not they should be allowed to stay. Killed off with government's help in the early 1900s, the Italian gray wolves reappeared in France in the early 1990s. Environmentalists couldn't be happier. Not only has a new species, an old species, returned, but the ecosystem is also healthy enough to support a new top-tier animal on the food chain. The problem is the wolves' food chain includes sheep. And despite appearances, sheep are $1 billion a year big business in France, and the sheep owners want the wolves dead, but the wolves are protected. I saw a wolf in St. Paul, Minnesota, in the city itself. And I keep telling people this, and the DNR people of Minnesota don't believe me, but my son and I both saw it about a year ago. I mean, a full-grown wolf within the city limits. And part of the problem was it was on Halloween night 1 year ago. And when we called it in, even though police officer came to the scene and everything, they were all very skeptical that it had something to do with the party, but it didn't. We were out walking our dog near a park, and the wolf came right up to the edge of this rather large park near our house and was staring at our dog like it was a Totina's pizza roll or something. It wanted that dog in the worst way. Now, this is a cool story that's on the coasttocoastam.com website, along with several other very neat stories tonight. Israeli archaeologists on Saturday said they have discovered what may be the oldest Christian church in the Holy Land on the grounds of a prison near the biblical site of what is considered to be Armageddon, or Har Megiddo. Megiddo is actually the name of the area, Har Megiddo, Har being Hebrew for mountain. The Israeli Antiques Authority said the ruins are believed to date back to the 3rd or 4th centuries and include references to Jesus and images of fish. This is a very ancient structure, maybe the oldest in our area, said the head archaeologist on the dig. The dig took place over the last 18 months at the Megiddo prison in northern Israel, with the most significant discoveries taking place in the last 2 weeks. Scholars believe Megiddo to be the New Testament's Armageddon, the site of the final war between good and evil. The Antiquities Authority in Israel said more than 60 prison inmates took part in the dig in recent months. And they can tell that it is a Christian church. They believe it's a very old church. And it, if I'm not mistaken, if I'm reading this right here, they believe, too, that that it says right there the original youth pastor was Billy Graham. I don't know if that'll bear out to be truth, but take a look for yourself. Many automatic garage doors in Ottawa have suddenly and strangely stopped working due to a powerful radio signal that appears to be interfering with the remote controls that open them. Have you heard? They're still working on it right now. The Ram overhead door systems say the phenomenon began last weekend. It affects a 25-mile radius. That's huge. The door doctor has also received more than 100 calls from irate customers who can't get their garage doors open. Lift masters, everybody's working on it. So far, nobody's been able to understand it. I believe it's evidence of an invasion. It's coming. You know, the first thing, if the government was going to invade, the first thing they would do is take away our leaf blowers. So we'll be watching. As to last week's guest, Dr. Judith Orloff, many people wrote in. In fact, I think probably all of the mail was specifically about her. One guy here identified himself as Gage, said, however, that he took exception to her discussion about psychic vampires, about energy vampires. Now, she talked about it only in the negative, which has only been my experience as well. But he says here he is a newly awakened psi vamp, which I can only assume is psychic vampire, and I hate that that lady called me a parasite. I am no leech. I have a regular donor friend of mine who not only allows me to drain her, she actually enjoys it. Buck wrote, was listening to your show on psychic vampires. Wow. A few years ago, a friend and I were talking about this stuff like this when he said that he could do it too, be a psychic vampire. I didn't believe him, of course, so he said he would show me. He said, stick out your hand. So I did. He said, I'm going to draw out some energy from you. Tell me if you can feel it. He then put his hand over mine. What I felt was not energy flowing out, but a cold feeling going in me and a sense of energy. At that same time, my friend almost fell to the floor and blacked out. When he was able to talk, he said that when he made contact, that somehow I was able to draw his energy out before he could break contact. He asked me if I did it on my own. I told him I had no idea what I had done or how I did, if I did. It scared him so much, he stayed as far away from me as he could. All of this makes me wonder if this is why I try to keep as far a distance from people as I can. Been this way all my life. Thanks, Buck. Also, this story about Dr. Judith Orloff and her discussion about how kids can be taught intuition and should be taught intuitive skills when they're very young. This past Saturday show, writes Jason, was extremely interesting. It reminded him of a story. It just happened. My wife and I planned a birthday party for my 1-year-old daughter, Olivia, and we ordered a party tent for the backyard. It was Friday afternoon, the day of the party, and my wife and I were getting things in order. We had our 2.5-year-old twins, Vince and Leo, outside with us. Two gentlemen from the rental company parked the truck at the street and started walking up the driveway. Leo immediately began to cry and gripped my wife's leg for her attention. We figured that he was just being a 2-year-old and was having an episode. While the driver and his partner explained what they were going to do, Leo was clinging to my wife and crying while she held him. When the man retreated to the vehicle, I approached them to pay the balance owed in cash. The driver took the remaining balance, and due to the fact that he had his hands full, I assumed he would provide me with a receipt upon completion of the job. My wife took the boys into the house, and I continued with the preparation for the party. When the two men were done, they gave me a few instructions about the tent and then left. An hour before the party, my wife received a call from the rental company explaining that there had been an incident involving the driver at some point after he had left, in which cash was stolen from the vehicle. The individual explained that this had happened on a previous occasion as well and wanted to know if we would be willing to write out a check for the remaining balance to give the driver when they came back to disassemble the tent. Well, as it turns out, and I'll try and shorten the story here a bit, the driver was stealing from the company whenever anybody would pay them in cash. He would take the money and then claim that they had been ripped off. It had happened once before. Not only was he doing that, but that very same driver that accepted the cash was also the one making the phone call to the parties that had given him the cash and telling them that the driver had been ripped off. But it was actually him trying to establish a backstory, trying to cover his tracks. So Jason goes on to say, I told my wife that our son Leo is intuitive and somehow knew that this guy was bad news. Leo wasn't just being a 2-year-old after all. Maybe our children can teach us a thing or two about intuition. Jason from East Amherst, New York. And then finally, this one from Tim in Louisville, Kentucky, who wrote to coasttocoastam.com to say this about Judith Orloff, Dr. Judith Orloff. Sure, she knows this about psychic vampires. Count Orloff is the name of the vampire in the original silent movie Nosferatu. And as soon as he wrote it, of course, he's right. That's exactly right. That was the name they gave. They didn't use Dracula because they couldn't get the rights to it. So they used Count Orloff. And that is Dr. Judith Orloff's name. Although that's probably where the similarity ends. I mean, she's got beautiful red curly hair. And she doesn't have sharp front teeth like an egg-sucking weasel, like Count Orloff does. And her head is not shaped like a light bulb, like his. But fair enough. Wish I'd made the connection myself earlier. And thank you, everybody, who makes connections by picking up on things in the show and sending them in. A friend of mine made a connection, or maybe it's not one. Maybe it's just a coincidence. But something amazing happened to my friend Terry Esau. He's a writer of books, tours around the country. And he called me earlier this week to give me the background on a story which had gotten coverage on Coast to Coast AM and just about everywhere else. A huge mainstream tragedy of a pastor who had gotten electrocuted during the course of a baptism. But it's what happened before that, which is challenging the people that saw Pastor Kyle Lake be executed. It's challenging them to make a connection, or maybe not. But you need to hear everything about this story. You might have heard the snippets in the news. You might even have read a little bit about it, maybe even seen the TV stories. But you haven't heard everything until we come back on Coast to Coast AM, This is Ian Punnett. Well, you have heard the story, the tragedy of Reverend Kyle Lake in Waco, Texas, who had been electrocuted in front of the whole congregation during a baptism. But you haven't heard everything about this yet. And in fact, what is a true tragedy, I mean, just anytime anybody's killed at a time like this, is really takes on a very different turn when you hear the whole story and you know what the largely student congregation has been having to deal with all week long. Because it wasn't just having their pastor killed in front of their eyes, which is horrible enough, but it's what was discussed before it happened, which we'll get to coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Terry Esau is the founder of a company called The Coast, a music production house, which has been specializing in writing, arranging, and producing commercial jingles for years. I love hearing Terry sing his commercial jingles whenever he talks, so I won't ask him to do it now. But just go over, if you would, Terry, the jingles that people might actually know you for across the country.
Oh, I don't know. I've done Target,
McDonald's.
Pepsi, yeah, McDonald's.
Kitty litter?
Kitty litter.
What was the kitty? What was the kitty litter you did? What was the cat litter you did?
I'm not going to sing it to you. Don't.
You don't have to sing it, but I mean, what was the product for? Do you remember?
You know, I think I actually did more than one cat litter
you had,
product. So.
You were the go-to guy on cat litter for the industry for a while?
Yeah, and I've never had a cat, but, you know.
Well, and then you also did many herbicide commercials and
yes.
Stuff. Okay.
Other things I'm not terribly proud of, but, you know.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. You get help in farmers.
Hey, Ian, before we start, can I just say one thing?
Yes, sir.
And I don't want to put a wet blanket on this interview, but, you know, I've been on hold on the phone here listening for the last half hour or so, and you've talked to, you know, you've had stories about psychic vampires and induced
yes,
after-death experiences and all kinds of stuff, and I've got to tell you, I'm a little uneasy lumping my experiences in this story in with those as just another story. And I'm not saying you're doing that, but I've got to tell you, I have vowed to respect and honor, you know, Kyle Lake and the memory of him. And there's something that feels a little funky to me that we're talking about that stuff, and now we're talking about this. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, I'm glad you're clear and open about this. I don't think you understand yet what then induced after-death communication is about.
Well, I probably don't, but...
This is a psychiatrist of some... whose research has been well-respected for years... in fact, the foreword for this book is written by Dr. Raymond Moody, and it really is dealing very specifically with people who are experiencing grief and trauma who go through a process of communication. It's not hypnosis, and he'll talk more about what that is.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure why when you hear that, why you should feel like you're getting quote-unquote lumped in with something.
Well, you know, we're talking about psychic vampires. I just feel like there's a, you know, I witnessed this. I saw it. And I, you know, we held back from talking about this and connecting it with the surprise me thing for this whole week. And just be, you know, out of respect to Kyle. And I just, I don't know. That's my gut that just said, you got to say this before we continue. So I said it.
Well, I want to respect that. And I want to move forward. But I can't tell if you want to or not. Because
no, I want to, because okay. I think this is an important story. And I think what we have to say, I think it enhances the honor for Kyle and talks about who he was and maybe a little bit about who God is, too. So I think it's important.
Okay. Well, I wouldn't, just for the sake of reference, I wouldn't dismiss the work of of Judith Orloff on that issue either. She's a very respected person in her field. And
I know. I'm a rookie.
The whole idea of energy vampires, of people you know who you meet who suck all the life out of you. Why are those people like that? And how does that happen? She just happens to believe it's not a metaphor or an expression, but really something that some people are wired to do.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's not a, she's not joking either.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure she's not.
Well, that having been said,
okay.
Then, you need to go through this then at your comfort level in as much as you experienced it and start with, the background that led you up to be where you were that day, because I've known you for years and I knew you as you were beginning to make the transition from jingle writer to full-time writer. Your first book, Blue Collar God, White Collar God, was, as we describe it, you know, coming out of a need to do something which you cared about.
Right.
And this new book surprised me. Was a pleasure to write about. It was a simple idea in which you decided at the beginning of each day for a 30-day period just to challenge yourself with that prayer and then to be open to whatever happened from that. Talk a little bit about how you that first came to you. You were watching TV, was it?
I was watching some reality TV, and I just, you know, you're watching them do whatever they do on that, and you go, what do these producers want you to take from this? And I think they want you to believe that you're eavesdropping on this spontaneous, unscripted adventure. And I thought, you know, I actually thought about creating a reality spirituality show, you know, like the God Factor or something. And then I realized that there was a lot of bad religious TV on already. I didn't want to add to that. But I thought, you know, I don't want to do a TV show, but I think it would be cool if my own personal faith had more of that spontaneous, unscripted, raw, real, alive adventure to it. And so I just got this idea. I thought, I'm going to take my spiritual agenda, everything that I think I'm doing for God and the things I'm asking him to do for me or whatever, I'm going to put that aside for 30 days, and I'm going to go over and I'm going to say, God, no expectations, no stipulations, no agenda. I'm going to say three words every day. Surprise me, God. And whatever happens, I'm going to try to observe it, try to engage with it. I decided I was going to keep a journal of everything that happened, everybody I talked to, what we talked about, my thought processes of what we talked about, and then just basically see what it looked like. You know, and what I was hoping, I think, was to in some way, jumpstart my faith and give it a little more of that raw, real thing so that it played a bigger part in the everydayness of my life.
And one of those typical experiences, which I wrote about in the book, is the day you were just going to go out riding your bike. You were training for a bike marathon, was it?
No, it was a bike race that was coming up that I had gotten third in the previous year. So I was training really hard, and I headed out with the intention of doing an extremely hard training ride. And I get a half mile from my house and come upon a guy who's not going very fast. So I'm ready to go cruise around him. And I felt like I was hearing this voice, not literally, but saying, what if this guy is a player in the surprise me thing? Because I just started my experiment praying, surprise me, God. And I thought, okay, well, I'll slow down. I'll say hi to him. I'll give him 15 feet. If he says something surprising, I'll talk to him. And one of the first things out of his mouth was, I just got back from climbing Mount McKinley. And I kind of said, shoot, I guess I have to listen to this guy now. So we talked a little bit, and then he started asking me what I did, and he said, what are you working on now? I said, I'm on day two of a 30-day spiritual experiment where I pray, surprise me, God, and see what happens. And he said, "Do you want to be surprised?" And he proceeded to tell me how he just got back from this climb and his buddy had been killed on the climb. And he said it was even more complicated than that because in this expedition, everybody had roles, and this guy's role was to be the first guy out on the rope every time on ascents and descents. And he said, "I had been the first guy out on the rope every time, at least 50 times up till that point. There's only one time where he wasn't the first guy on, and it was the time that his buddy went, and he was killed." So he was on this ride trying to wrestle with why he was still alive, because he thought, "I should have been the dead guy." And we were actually able to have a great talk that day. And
well, and that's a good example of what typically might happen for you on a day as you were journaling about this experience. So the book is written, the book is published, Surprise Me is out, and no surprise, it's doing really well. People are buying it. You're getting buzz on it across the country at different congregations, and one of those is a church near where your daughter goes to college.
Right.
And it goes to Baylor, and so it was shaping up to be one of those perfect, you know, author weekends where you get that trifecta of book attention, and you also get to hang out with your daughter, you can get some family attention. Anytime an author can go to a city where they've got friends and family,
exactly,
kind of nice to combine all that. Plus, you were asked to come and speak to the university, so you were getting, you know.
Yeah, they had a cancellation and called me and said, "Can you speak on the 31st, Halloween?" And I said, "Sure.
Okay.
I'm going to be there. I'm going to be in Waco visiting my daughter." And then a couple days before I left, I got an email from Kyle Lake, the pastor of University Baptist Church, and he said, "Terry, we're going to start your Surprise Me experiment with our whole church on Sunday." And I sent him an email back and said, "Wow, that's really cool. I'm going to be there." So he said, "Well, stop in." And he said, "I'll introduce you, and I'll maybe ask you a few questions, and we can talk about it. So it'll be great."
And Kyle Lake, for people who don't know, was a prominent guy in a particular type of Christianity, sort of what we call emergent Christianity, very cutting edge, very just a down-to-earth guy.
Right.
And the kids in that congregation, there's like 1,000 people who are a member of that congregation. They dug him because he spoke to them clearly, and they liked everything about him.
Yeah, he was a real guy that really communicated with the students and the churches. Almost all college students.
So you're there on the 30th, and he gets up in front of the congregation, and he talks about the book Surprise Me, introduces you.
Yeah, well, they're introducing the concept and saying, "Here's what Surprise Me is. Here's what it looks like. We're going to do this with our whole congregation for the next 30 days. They had, you know, the cover of the book up on the screens in front, and you know, and about 10 minutes later, he steps into the baptismal. He reaches up to adjust the mic or something, and, you know, and all of a sudden it's chaos.
Right.
And somebody's yelling, "Call 911, and they pull him out, and, you know, the church is looking on in this stunned silence. And I'm, you know, my first thought, which is ridiculous, but my first thought was, wow, they're doing some bizarre get to illustrate the Surprise Me concept. You know, they're trying to shock us because they like doing stuff like that, you know, there that just kind of would really grab your attention. And, you know, all of a sudden I realized this is real.
This is
actually happening.
And that's right after talking about, telling people we're going to do the Surprise Me experiment, we're going to write down the things that surprise us. And the idea, too, is that you're going to write down authentically what they are. You're not just going to try and make up stuff or try and skew the experiment by only writing down the good things.
No, this is a reality-based experiment, you know, where I wanted it to be an honest look at faith. This is not asking God to prove himself or show signs. This is saying it's more of a test for us. Can we be the fleece? Can we soak up the holy water, the incidences of the day?
So how do you handle that one? And how, because right away then you have to speak the next day.
Yeah.
And you've got a congregation full of people who have been looking on in horror and disbelief. And now they're having to sort out, surprise me, in regard to what they just saw.
I'll tell you that I was probably as stunned as anybody, and I sat there, and my first reaction was, God, what are you doing? I mean, this just doesn't make any sense. You know, and then the anger kind of started fading, and it turned into this confusion and grief and intense sadness. And, you know, yeah, that night I thought, I talked to the campus pastor of Baylor, and I said, I don't need to speak tomorrow. If you need to deal with this, and you knew him much better than I did, I can step aside. And he said, Terry, there are so many, quote, coincidences that brought you here today. There was a cancellation. That's why we brought you in. And all these things that came together that I don't have time to tell you about. And he said, I think that you're supposed to talk to the students tomorrow.
So in sorting this out now, I mean, here you have not had quite a week yet. And I know you've heard from other people, and this story is getting traction around the country as people are discovering that this was the topic just before the baptism and the tragedy that happened in the pool. And so as you're sorting it out, as people are talking about it, are they making a connection? And how are you handling that thought that if you have to be honest, this is was a huge surprise. Was this, do you think, something that comes as a result of asking to be surprised?
You know, I wish I could answer that. I honestly, truly don't know. It you know, does that gets you into all kinds of really, really hard questions. Does God cause everything to happen? Or is there tragedy and chaos and stuff in the world because it's the natural consequences of humankind and our, you know, freedom of choice? I mean, Kyle talked about that in his book. I don't know.
What do you think Kyle would have said, Kyle Lake would have said about this?
You know, part of me wonders if he wouldn't have quoted a bumper sticker that I'm not sure if I should say on radio.
Oh,
you know, garbage happens.
Yeah.
And I think he would have said, you know, there are laws of nature, electrical laws, and they were violated that day, and I was in a really bad place where the violation happened.
Had he ever adjusted a microphone like that while being in the pool before, that you know?
I don't know. I assume probably he has. I'm sure thousands of pastors have done that through the course of time.
And as you get kids who are writing in who witnessed the tragedy at the service and who are writing on your website, what are they saying about it? How are they making a connection, or how are they disconnecting those two things?
You know what? They're wrestling with it. And when I spoke at chapel the next day, I invited them to question and wrestle. Because I've always believed that God is not intimidated by our questions. And I told them, I said, I don't have the answer. I can't tell you why this happened. I said, I can tell you that I already see good things coming from it. But that doesn't necessarily validate it happening.
Right.
But I, in wrestling, helping and trying to engage in the wrestling of these students, I see a lot of people who are going, you know, we don't know how long we get to live. And maybe I should take more seriously this day that I have. Maybe I should look more at what is the purpose of my life? Who is God? How does he fit in with me? What's my story? What is our story? Where do we go from here? You know, and if people can start wrestling with these questions instead of just putting their lives on cruise control and saying, it is what it is. I need to make money. I need to be comfortable. then I think some good has come from it.
Well,
you know, and I think Kyle would be, I think he would be pleased with that.
That's the whole story of what everybody heard in the news last week, for them to consider for themselves and for them to sort out, just like everybody does who now knows the whole story from Terry Esau, author of the book Surprise Me. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. Terry, thanks again for being so open about all of that, and we'll continue that conversation, I'm sure, in the email. And coming up next hour, Dr. Alan Bodkin, clinical psychologist with over 20 years of experience, says he can induce after-death communication.